This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Listeners of Sons of Patriarchy, Peter Bell here, producer of the podcast. Just so you know, we are turning ads on for this series, and the reason is simple. We need to cover our costs. It takes a lot of money to run this, as everything has been self-funded up to this point. We ran this past the Sons of Patriarchy team, as well as the survivor community, and we have received the green light to act on this decision. These ads will not be intrusive, nor will they be random. They will occur at the beginning and end of each episode. There will be no interruptions during the content of each. With this decision, we are earmarking 25% of the revenue these ads generate towards outreach, which exclusively provides resources for survivors of the movements we are exposing and profiling. The rest will go to cover our costs and our time in producing this series. If you would like to donate directly to our efforts, find the outreach link in the show notes. There you can give a single or recurring donation. Along with this, we are turning on Apple subscriptions. $4.99 per month will give you access to ad-free listening. You can also sign up for the same on our Patreon account, link in the show notes. Now, let's get on with the episode. Our progress in the past usually came slowly, and a recovery will come slowly. It will come as men, each in their sphere of action, begin the task of reconstruction. Reconstruction begins with our lives in God's grace. It extends to our vocations, our institutions, homes, and society. Life and progress are made up of a great number of little things. We cover a mile by small steps, and the surest move forward is that small step rather than a giant daydream. From The Roots of Reconstruction by R.J. Rushdoony. The elites have run modern culture for so long, so how's it shaping up? Are you any better off? Do you have more money in your account? Are your values being questioned? Are you now the minority after so long having been the majority? These questions ping around the news so often you start to believe them. You start wondering, has it ever been this bad? You don't like change. No one likes change. It brings the unknown from some far-off land to under your nose. Your people group, your traditions, your way of life, they weren't a way of doing things. They were the way of doing things. Everything has been measured by the dominant narratives you've been told and shaped for by decades. So when you're told, over and over and over again, that society is breaking down, and your eyes are trained to see everything through that lens, change is bad. Change is unbiblical. Change is demonic. Your way of life has been assumed for so long, your response to this change may not go further than, but this is how it's always been. You're told to fear change. You're told to guard against change. You're told to villainize change. You start hearing about this movement, a couple decades old, that called society back to God's law. You've been a Christian for as long as you can remember, and maybe there's this vague memory of having been taught something similar to this. The reason the nation is going backwards is because we've lost sight of who God is. Your ears perk up. Your heart flutters. We gotta go back to God's law. That's key. You peruse online messaging boards, social media, and Christian podcasts. You start learning about this thing called Christian nationalism, and it sounds like an old friend, like a book that you haven't opened in a while, but you remember reading it at one point. Your intellect is tickled. There's something to this, you say to yourself. And there's a name you keep running across, who wrote more books than you've ever read, who is fighting the same tide you're fighting now, R.J. Rushdoony. It's sufficiently strange enough of a name that you begin digging deeper. And you are enthralled. This is what we need. In a nation without laws, we need the law. But if you dig deeper, you might notice that what you're looking for isn't return to God's law, it's return to your way of life. And if the law of God gives you that back, you're all in. It means more than society's got to change. It's got to go back. It means society needs to fall so we can reconstruct. And now you've got a blueprint. Welcome to episode 5, The Reconstruction of Nationalism. In this episode, we'll discuss the immediate precursor to the modern movement of Christian nationalism, Christian Reconstructionism. And while some of the ideas are similar, you'll learn just how far apart they really are. They just don't work. I'll talk to Michael McVicker of Florida State University, repeat guest Jerome Kapolsky of Georgetown, Julie Ingersoll of the University of North Florida, and interact with some of the ideas of Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers, whom you'll hear from in the next episode. Let's begin with Dr. McVicker, likely the world's foremost authority on Reconstructionism and Rushdoony.
Okay, I'm Michael McVicker. I'm an associate professor at Florida State University. I guess if I'm known for a book, it's for Christian Reconstruction and R.J. Rushdoony and American Religious Conservatism.
Maybe you're asking yourself, what is Christian Reconstructionism and why should I care? Isn't this some fringe Christian idea? What's the use in learning about it? I asked Mike about this, and here's his answer.
So the way I understand Christian Reconstructionism, and you could probably ask three different scholars who have studied it and get three different opinions. You could probably ask a dozen different Reconstructionists and also get different definitions. So I tend to approach it the way Rushdoony did, because that's where I spent most of my time studying it. And Rushdoony understood Reconstruction or Christian Reconstruction as being a kind of social theological project that was aimed at the framing here of reconstructing American or more broadly human societies through the application of biblical law. For him, that took a sort of narrow understanding of looking at what he would have understood as Old Testament Jewish law, understanding that as still being binding for the most part. Now, there are some caveats to that, but still being binding on humanity. Most of what wasn't binding is the ritual law, but the actual civil laws, he understood it was still binding on human beings today. That had largely been, in his view, abandoned by the church, and the church construed broadly Catholic and Protestant and Orthodox Christians. And in abandoning that, they had essentially given over dominion or given over the rule of human beings, the law that governed human beings, to secular authorities. And so what he saw as his project was the progressive sort of reclaiming of that law and making it binding again on human beings and then human institutions. So the different spheres of human governance. That meant in terms of state governance, it also meant in terms of family governance, and also in terms of economic governance. So he had this sort of expanding view of what this meant. And for him, this was a project that could last essentially millennia, right? It could take decades, it could take hundreds of years, it could take thousands of years in order to reconstruct human beings. So it was also that vision of law still being binding was also coupled with his own unique postmillennial view. This idea that human beings would slowly and methodically bring humans under God's law and reestablish a kind of millennial kingdom on earth, and eventually Christ would return to rule that kingdom. So it's this really complicated sort of worldview of binding humans to God's law in order to allow Christ ultimately to govern the planet.
The keys here are what needs reconstructing, how you reconstruct it, and what you reconstruct it with. American society has fallen, Rushdoony might say today, and you'll hear some of these talking points from his modern disciples, and we need to reconstruct it. This is opposed to the rise of the Moore majority towards the latter end of Rushdoony's career that said something like, America has been a Christian nation, and she's just lost her roots. We need to resurrect it. Rushdoony would say, America is dead. Democracy didn't work. In case you're wondering, Reconstructionists have been saying this for a while, going back to the Civil War. Here's Jerome Kapolsky, fellow at the Berkeley Center at Georgetown University, introduced in episode 4. I asked him, is Reconstructionism new? Have they always been saying this?
They're not brand new, but they're new, but they're, of course, they're not completely original, right? Rushdoony is interesting because Rushdoony argues in some of his early essays on American history that America was really founded as a Christian nation, sort of, right? That the Constitution was meant to, what he says, perpetuate a Christian order, mm-hmm. right? The Christian order was on the ground. It was mostly a Calvinist Christian order. And the Constitution didn't do anything to push that away. The Constitution was meant to just kind of keep that right steady state. And the problem that Rushdoony identifies that really changes the changes America from being a mostly a Calvinist set of states to what we had, you know, in the 60s when he's writing these texts is religious deviance, is religious heresy, is Unitarianism, right? Hmm. The Unitarian break from Calvinism really begins this decline that he sees as a decline into the secularism of the 20th century. And he looks at the way in which sort of Unitarians created American institutions like the public school and then used the public school to catechize, right, to indoctrinate, instruct gotcha. America into this false religion. He sometimes calls it the religion of humanity. And, you know, I mean, we were talking earlier, it's not like religion versus secularism, but like who's the monopoly of religion versus the religions that are wrong. Rushdoony believed that most of American Christianity was wrong insofar as it broke from Calvinism and it became a kind of a pietistic, emotive, giving up this high theological notions that Calvinism was endorsing, and also giving up what he believed was the teachings that Christianity was to be, in a sense, incarnated into social institutions. Now, not from the top down. He also saw one of the great problems was the state as an institution. Hmm. Right. So that Rushdoony believed that was a post-millennialist. He believed that Christians were building the kingdom on earth, that essentially the Christ was not going to come back until after the Christian, right. So it was the project of Christians to exert dominion over the world, over the earth. One of the ways that they would do that, he came to believe, was through biblical law, right? The law, the Mosaic legislation that is described in the Pentateuch. Those were laws that were still appropriate for a Christian society.
Yep.
And so he juxtaposed a society that was based on biblical law, on divine legislation, to a society which was under the domination of the secular state and human legislation. So Rushdoony's own political theology was much more radical than other people on the religious right in this, right? Like a Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson.
Yep.
And there are we can look at the different theological distinctions of premillennialism versus postmillennialism, but we could also look at the idea that for Rushdoony, the project was to essentially create a new England, right? To create a new kind of Puritanism. That was what a Christian society would look like. It wasn't like it wasn't just going back to the status quo before 1947 and the Everson decision by the Supreme Court or the expansion of the religion clauses of the First Amendment to the states, right? He envisioned something much more radical in his project of Christian Reconstruction. Now, I want to say a word about Gary North, who was his one-time disciple and then broke away and became the leader of another faction of the Christian Reconstruction movement. Now, Gary North came to differ from Rush Dooney on the question of whether or not the founding was actually a Christian founding. Remember, as I mentioned, Dooney said, Constitution doesn't really mention the things that we would expect a Christian instrument to mention, but it was still there to perpetuate a Christian order. North came to challenge that idea and believe that the Constitution was actually a Masonic conspiracy against Christianity. In the late 1980s, entitled Political Polytheism, which is essentially his critique of everybody. Critique of Australia's, critique of Francis Schaeffer's, critique of sort of young evangelical historians for weighing in on the question of Christian nationalism. But the core of the book is that the founding was the Constitution Convention was a conspiracy, and it was a Masonic conspiracy against Orthodox Christianity.
Yep, I've heard this. Yep.
And Rush Dooney had got it wrong. Rush Dooney wasn't able to see straight when it came to the Constitution. He wasn't able to sort of follow the courage of his convictions and see that the neutrality of the Constitution was anything but neutral. It was actually creating the false god of we the people. And in that book, North said, well, what is to be done, right? What should Christians of this Northian complexion do? And they should lobby for a Christian amendment. Interestingly enough, the book is dedicated to the Reformed Presbyterians. Now, he wasn't engaged with Samuel Wiley or some of these other.
You see the parallels, though, for sure.
Yeah, you see the parallels, and North was very clear that there was a direct line from the Reformed Presbyterian critique of the Constitution to what he was doing in political polytheism.
There's been different flavors of Christian Reconstructionists and different ways of looking at civil and political engagement. The thing they all agree on? The Constitution won't do what we want it to do. It will not hold up God's law as we desire. We need to scrap it and start anew. We need to reconstruct. Rush Dooney popularized these ideas in political theological theories for modern age, but they weren't necessarily new. Here's another scholar, someone who hasn't just researched the topic, but lived under it.
Hi, Peter. My name is Julie Ingersoll, and I am a professor of religious studies at the University of North Florida. Although this research actually spans about 30 years for me, probably. So I've been at a number of institutions over that period of time. My first book was on evangelical Christian women and war stories. That was women who were sort of caught. The book came out in 2003. It was actually my dissertation. And the women, there was a rise of interest in egalitarianism and having women leaders in evangelical organizations at the time. But there was also a very strong backlash at that same time. And so a lot of women who believed that they were invited in to spaces that were characterized by equality and leadership opportunities found themselves just sort of slapped down by a handful of people in those organizations. And then often the organizations would kind of back away from their commitment to egalitarianism and make arguments about, oh, just letting everybody believe what they believe, which is fine in theory, but in practice, it kind of left the women hanging out to dry. So I wrote about the crises that they experienced as a result of that, both in terms of their jobs, but for people who are outside these worlds, it's sometimes hard for them to understand how integrated a sense of calling is. It's not just your work. It's actually everything about who you understand yourself to be. So when the parachurch organization that women were working for left them out to dry, it led to a crisis at kind of every level of their personality and their social groups. Really devastating, actually. And then my more recent book is on Christian Reconstruction. And the basic argument of the book is that this is the most important movement that you've never heard of. And I kind of lay out the basic framework of Christian Reconstruction, because a lot of contemporary Christians talk about taking a biblical approach to law and society and life and all of those components. And to people who are uninitiated, that sounds, oh, yeah, fine. That's nice. Yeah. Sermon on the Mount, you know, okay. But they mean something really particular by it, and it is not incoherent. It's actually a very clearly articulated and thought out systematic approach. And so the book lays that out and explains it. And the second half of the book is all based in field research at different sites where Christian Reconstructionism has had an influence. Some of it is actually Christian Reconstructionist organizations explicitly, but others of it are, for example, there's a Christian school here in Florida that's been receiving tax money for a very long time. I mean, I was doing the research for this book in about 2009, and they were, I mean, their whole structure was built around state tax money coming into their school for support. And they were explicitly founded on the work of Rush Dooney and Rush Dooney. I didn't even know it when I set up my interview with them, but he was their first graduation speaker. They had Christian Reconstructionist materials in their library. I mean, this is who they are. And they were teaching that with taxpayer funds in the state of Florida, and still are, as far as I know. So the chapters span the kind of theology. So there's a heady sort of scholastic theology that's in the first couple of chapters. And then there's the sort of on the ground interpretation of the theology that people like Gary North did. And then there is the fieldwork based section that explores this kind of out in the world.
One of the key components here is the systemization of thought that Christian Reconstructionism offers. Let me explain. We live in an atomistic society, A-T-O-M, not A-D-A-M, wherein we lack integration of disciplines and different areas of life. Things are sectored off from each other. Schooling gets more and more focused or particularized the further on you go. Systems of thought don't cohere. They battle one another. So, when a system of theology and political engagement is on offer to Christians who are looking for cohesion and unity of thought, Reconstructionism offers something already made. It aims to make sense of the world and your part in it. What systems, doctrines, and/or political theories lie behind Christian Reconstructionism? What does it build off of and towards? I continue with Dr. Ingersoll.
So clearly, Mrs. John Rush Dooney is the founder of Christian Reconstructionism and clearly the most important figure. He started writing this stuff in the late 1950s. And his critique of public education that really was actually the linchpin. Okay, so the argument in my book that these are the most important version of Christianity that you've never heard of is that unlike a lot of other theologians, Rush Dooney instantiated his critique and his vision for society in a critique of public education and in a Christian school and then later Christian homeschool movement. And it was that instantiation into social institutions that led to his influence affecting broader aspects of the evangelical subculture and even the Christian subculture, broadly speaking, in the U.S., way outside Christian Reconstructionism and, frankly, outside circles where people have even ever heard of him. So just as an example, so Rush Dooney was key in theological argument and then making arguments in court settings that the education of children was a religious responsibility of parents and that it was therefore protected by free exercise of clause. And in doing so, courts across the country took a really strongly hands-off approach to what should happen in these Christian schools. They were independent. And then organizations like the Homeschool Legal Defense Association followed on Christian Reconstructionism to build a largely unregulated, unaccountable Christian homeschool movement across the country that is, by the way, often now funded by tax dollars in the form of vouchers and various other kinds of things in some states, but potentially also nationally with the stuff that's in Project 2025. Mm-hmm. So this Christian Reconstructionist inflected version of Christian education just expanded across the country in the evangelical subculture. So anybody who sent their kids to Christian schools, or frankly, anybody who homeschools their kids these days is influenced by Rush Dooney, even if they don't understand it, because the places where they go for curriculum, the organizations that they can be a part of for social interaction and all kinds of other things have just drunk from this well of Christian Reconstructionism. It's so broadly influential that it becomes kind of like the water in which we swim or the air that we breathe. And so the origins of it aren't always noticed. But That said, Rush Dooney was the pivotal figure, the first person to articulate this. And I think that Gary North, who was his son-in-law, would have to be the second most important figure if you're trying to rank them in this way. And I think that that's because what North did, North was much more of a tactician than Rush Dooney. Rush Dooney was a theologian. And while his ideas took root, and we could talk about how that happened, because the coincidence, and I don't mean coincidence, actually. Okay, so the way in which Rush Dooney's critique of public education coincided with desegregation was a historical accident that served Christian Reconstructionism really well. So the dominant story about how evangelicalism came to be in its current religious right politicized form always revolved around the Roe versus Wade decision.
Mm-hmm.
But historians, especially Randy Balmer, have really successfully, I think, argued that it really did come down to race. Well, Randy Balmer and Anthea Butler also, her book, White Evangelical Racism, is really important. And when you start to see the way, okay, so you have a Christian movement that is largely based in the U.S. South that is really unhappy about desegregation efforts.
Yep.
They don't necessarily want to say that. They will if you push it, but they don't really want to. And along comes Rush Dooney with this whole argument that, wait a minute, public education is unbiblical anyway. You shouldn't have your kids there. So they could just rush off and do their Christian thing that they, in their mind, separated from their motivation that had a whole lot to do with race. If desegregation hadn't been happening to motivate them to be unhappy with public schools, I'm not sure that Rush Dooney's appeal that public education is unbiblical would have had the sway that it did. I think that that moment was crucially important, and he happened to be there. But aside from the strategy of transforming education and critiquing education, Rush Dooney worked in the area of ideas. Gary North, on the other hand, was a tactician. One of his most, well, in my mind, there are actually a couple of works of his that are the most important. One is his book, Political Polytheism, where he basically argues that efforts at pluralism are effectively polytheistic and that they cannot live in any kind of compromise in a civil society with a biblical world, that those two things are mutually exclusive. So Political Polytheism argues that, but his Biblical Blueprint series was a series of books, booklets almost, that were written for everyday Christians in their churches. And he took Christian Reconstructionism as an ideological or theological or philosophical system and played out what it was going to look like in all these different areas of life. So there's one on economics and there's one on the family and there's one on education and there's one on international relations and any aspect of what it would mean to be a government. There, he's got one of these little books on, and different people wrote them, but he was the editor of the series. And there is a chapter of my book which goes through this series of books. And if you read it, you'll be shocked. If you read that Biblical Blueprint series chapter that I wrote that summarizes these blueprints, and then you read Project 2025, and you look at, for example, North says in, and I think he wrote the international, I don't want to get this wrong. In the Biblical Blueprint, let me start. Okay. In the Biblical Blueprint series, there's an argument made that the federal efforts, diplomacy and international relations and all of that should be focused entirely on business. So instead of having ambassadors, we should just have business people. And then you read Project 2025 and they want to completely dismantle all of the aspects of our federal bureaucracy that engage with diplomacy and treaty making and all that sort of stuff. And they want to replace them with business people. I'm not saying they got it from Gary North. I'm saying, again, that there's a subtle way that influence happens. And stuff kind of gets out there and it's in the air. And people pick it up and run with it because it matches up with some of the concerns that they're trying to articulate a defense for. And I think one of the reasons we've missed the significance of this movement is that we have an impoverished understanding of how ideas are spread, of how social groups work. We want to look for a one-to-one correspondence. You know, if we want to say that this movement influenced this social system. We want a book where there's footnotes. And that would be lovely, but it's often not there. And often what you have to do is listen for the echoes of the worldview playing themselves out in other places. So one of my favorite examples is if somebody's talking about government schools, they got that from Rush Dooney. They don't know necessarily that they got it from Rush Dooney, but public schools have always been called public schools. And so Rush Dooney came along and tried to make an argument that they were unbiblical. And they're unbiblical because for Rush Dooney, there's three different spheres of authority that God has ordained: the family, the church, and the civil government. And so they are unbiblical because they take a task that's assigned to families, raising children, and they assign it to an agency of the civil government. And so you can't understand these folks without understanding how those mechanisms work. But it's very subtle. It's very subtle. Even when Rush Dooney was writing, Rush Dooney's work is filled with complaints that people, like Francis Schaeffer, for example, took his ideas and ran with them without crediting him. I don't know that Schaeffer actually did do that. I'd have to look into that some more because they were kind of on a parallel track anyway, and they may have just come up with the same ideas at the same times apart from each other. But Rush Dooney was very clear that there were people out there using his ideas without crediting him because he was an unpopular figure. He advocated stoning teenagers who were recalcitrant three times, right? Nobody wanted to be associated with that.
A fear of government, indoctrination, immorality, and the judgment of God upon a nation or people group. Sound familiar? Julie brings up what Michael McVicker will continue on with, the growth of Christian Reconstructionism. What lies behind Christian Reconstructionism is also what grows it. It's not just a theory, it's a way of education, and it begins young. Back to Dr. McVicker. How did Rush Dooney capture and propel this movement? And why Rush Dooney?
Well, I mean, there's a couple ways of answering that. I mean, first of all, it's worth noting that whatever one thinks of this Christian Reconstruction, the project that Rush Dooney sort of named and articulated, while he did it in conversation with a lot of different theologians and a lot of different political activists and a lot of different sort of mid-century, that is mid-20th century thinkers, it is his creation. Nobody quite articulated this project in the way that he did it. Now, in some ways, we could argue that his eventual son-in-law, Gary North, was sort of the co-founder of this movement and sort of co-signer of the overall idea or political or theological project. However, Rush Dooney really is the sort of central figure. And I think partly because of how idiosyncratic it is. It is a unique project. There's no other... I mean, we could argue about other visions of postmillennial sort of Christian eschatology. We could argue about other forms of what we might think of like Christian right political activism. But nobody tried to systematically lay out a political, social, and theological project quite like Rush Dooney did. And nobody was quite as systematic about it in the mid-century period. So I'm talking about, you know, basically from the late 1940s well through the 1980s, sort of the heyday of the articulation of this project. There are other people who he collaborated with and also other people that he cultivated who sort of took parts of this project and made it their own, but none of them articulated it quite as clearly and quite as consistently as he did. At the same time, I mean, there is a way in which, I mean, we could talk about Rush Dooney's theological sort of education. Rush Dooney understood himself to be a legitimate theologian, right? Mm-hmm. Now, many of his peers did not, which is part of what's so interesting about this guy. He did have a theological education. It was really unusual, especially because his theological education actually circulated through mostly what we would consider sort of left-leaning or progressive, both institutions of higher learning like UC Berkeley, where he went to college, but also the Pacific School of Religion, which was in its time, and I mean still today, is considered a very theologically progressive institution. You know, Rush Dooney was convinced that most of his professors there had read more Marx than they had, you know, the scriptures, this kind of criticism. But he did have a theological education, but what mostly that theological education did was prompt him to be a kind of contrarian in his own day. So he was drinking deeply of this kind of, you know, left-leaning progressive theology. And at every turn, he was sort of pushing against it and trying to articulate a kind of alternative to it. So, you know, when you take those asking like what Reconstruction is, in some ways, it's actually a response to his educational sort of milieu in some ways.
Russ Dooney had what many in his camp didn't have, a prolific ability to craft an argument and a firm grasp on the cultural moment. Having been trained under theological liberals, he was a theological contrarian, a man of reaction. His rhetoric was bold, and it also bit. His theological, cultural, and political projects built more through reaction than construction. He was strategic in his partnerships, those he mentored, and whom he was mentored by. He built a system through voluminous writing, and his son-in-law, Gary North, continued his projects. But, as you'll hear later on in this episode, many of his disciples took his project in a direction he never would have. But we'll get there. Russ Dooney might have been the clearest and most poignant Reconstructionist thinker of his time, but how would he be contrasted with earlier Reconstructionists? What kind of trajectory do we see going back in time to the Revolutionary War, through the Civil War, and to the present? I asked Jerome Kapolsky for what has animated Reconstructionists new and old, as well as where they might differ.
One of the ways to think about this question is, what is the role of the state? What is the role of the polity? Is the role of the polity to create and shape Christians and lead people to a Christian life, to their salvation? Or is the role of the polity to create the space for human liberty, for individuals to figure that out for themselves? If it's the former, the state, this goes back to our earlier discussion about political theory and the emergence of liberalism. Mm-hmm. Is it the state's responsibility to teach and inculcate religion either for the good of the individual's salvation or for the good of obedience to the state? Right? The state with an established religion has an interest in people believing in that religion because they'll believe in the state and they'll believe in its sovereigns, right? Believe in its authorities, right? Or do we want the state to essentially stay out of it and just preserve our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? And that the state's authority does not need the religious obedience of its citizens. And I think you'll talk to Christians who will give you different stories on this and different answers on this. And it's not a liberal Christian versus conservative Christian divide. And there are many conservative Christians who do not want the state to be inculcating religion because, right, the odds are that it won't be their religion.
Yep. Yeah, this is one of Paul Miller's biggest things. I mean, he's conservative in many ways, but he does not want the state doing this.
Right? You talk about the deep state and you complain about the state bureaucrats. Do you want those deep state bureaucrats telling you what to believe and how to
worship? Exactly. Yeah.
And do you say, again, I think this comes down to having perspectives and being able to live in a society. We're not a pluralistic society. The fundamental fact that we face is pluralism. Like, we're not going to undo that, right? Mm-hmm. America, and that was, as I said earlier, one of the reasons why the church-state settlement happened the way it did was because of the reality of religious pluralism and the desire to not have religious violence. And there's a lesson there. And I think that the Christian nationalists are not seriously thinking about that historical lesson. The assumption is that, they'd be on top and that everyone would follow suit. I think there's no historical evidence for them to be confident of that, and a lot of evidence to suggest that using the mechanism of the state to enforce religious beliefs and behavior will only lead to hypocrisy at best and violence at worst.
And you can hear the Christian nationalists saying, well, it's not going to happen this time. We're going to figure it out.
You go back to Russ Dooney and North, and I think one of the interesting things about their writings is that they're thinking in the long durée. They're not thinking that this is going to happen in the next election cycle. Wait, in 1,000 years, it'll come.
No, totally. Yeah, I think hundreds of years from now, we got to slowly build this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if that's your vision, you can build that in a liberal democratic space. And who knows in 1,000 years, right? In the meantime, there's a difference between having a church preaching this and creating intentional communities, right? To live out this vision. There's a difference between doing that and trying to have laws that sort of control the lives of other people, to have other people sort of join this vision against their will.
It can be difficult to sum up Christian Reconstructionism because of how it's grown and shifted throughout the last century. It also could be easy to misunderstand their project or confuse their project. Jerome Kapolsky offers a few criticisms for those who may misunderstand Reconstructionism, Rush Juni, and their projects. If we're going to criticize the project, we better know what it is first.
You know, I think that there's a wonderful book that I'm going to, if you haven't read it already, it's a intellectual biography of Rush Juni, written by Michael McVicker. And one of the, you know, in a way they became the boogeyman, so to speak, for secularists, who are like, here's a group of theocratic tyrants who want to come in and sort of institute biblical law tomorrow, mm-hmm. right? They're essentially like the American Taliban, right? That's the way that they were all described. In evangelical circles, they had a lot of influence in, particularly Rush Juni, in having these ideas of kind of political Christianity enter into the discourse and seeing the relationship of America and American history and Christianity. So there's a famous book that came out in the early 1980s by Francis Schaeffer called A Christian Manifesto.
Yep.
Which comes out early on during the Reagan administration, is arguing the Reagan administration is this open window for us to retake a restorationist mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. But if we don't, you know, if we're not successful, we may have to think in terms of civil disobedience and resistance. And he tells the story of the founders being influenced by the Scottish Reformation and the role of Samuel Rutherford and his Lex Rex and the political thinking of the founding generation. And a lot of that stuff was actually taken from Rush Juni, even though it's not mentioned in the text. It was, and Rush Juni and Northup, there was a lot of complaining that Schaeffer was... not acknowledging his
forces, I've heard this before. Do you think that was intentional by Schaeffer, that he didn't want to be connected with them, or do you think that was unintentional?
That's a complicated backstory, and North and Gary DeMar write an article essentially with attacking Schaeffer for not being explicit with the use of Rush Juni, and also for failing to take the next step and say, if that is the case, we don't want to go back to this notion of religious freedom where, you know, this free market in religion where Jews and Protestants and Catholics and others are just kind of selling their wares and in the spiritual marketplace, because there is a true religion and the state should enforce that true religion. Mm-hmm. And that is theocracy, right? What we want, what the Reconstructionists want, is theocracy. If Schaeffer had followed through on the logic of what he had taken from Rush Juni, he would land in the same place. Mm-hmm. But people like Schaeffer and other people within the religious right, like Jerry Falwell, were afraid of theocracy, right? They were still kind of stuck in this liberal democracy space. And therefore, they could not acknowledge in a forthright manner their debt to Rush Juni, because doing so would demonstrate where they were coming from and where their ideas led. So there was a lot of frustration on the part of Reconstructionists that even as their ideas were in the circulatory system of the religious right, they were entering into it in an incomplete form and without the proper attribution.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've heard this before, and it's what you just provided was a helpful perspective, holistic. I've heard very similar things about Falwell, Schaeffer, and others, where they were trying to tiptoe the line a little bit, and then they got called out, and they wouldn't quite go all the way because they kind of knew the implications if we went all the way with this project, what that would mean. So that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you had people on the secular side who would say, In fact, this is where it goes, right? This is really what the religious right is after, right? They won't admit it, but they really want theocracy. But Rush, Dooney, and North would actually say the problem with people like Falwell is that, you know, they don't actually believe in creating a Christian polity, Christian, you know, commonwealth, because they think that, like, Jesus is going to come back and fix everything. Right, the sick, right? Because of their premillennial dispensationalism, they are theologically incapable of envisioning Christian reconstruction. Hmm.
Both criticisms from Kapolsky are too important not to repeat again. Secularists can assume Reconstructionists are setting up a theocratic Taliban tomorrow, and evangelicals might assume they're no different from, or the background for, Christian nationalists. Both are simplistic and incorrect. This is a long-term project, a really long-term project, and it bears almost no resemblance to the modern Christian nationalist project. Both sides may cite Rush Dooney, but it's clear they don't understand him. Here's Julie Ingersoll on the first criticism that Kapolsky offered, long-term thinking in Reconstructionist circles.
And, you know, we started talking also when you asked what it was like being part of that world. And I talked to you a little bit about how much things have changed, really. I think he's just a perfect example of that. And so there are ways in which he might be different from what Rush Dooney said in 1967. No doubt there is. But this is, again, a place where we misunderstand how social movements work. Nothing's frozen in time.
No.
All of this exists in a context. What, do you think he just fell out of a coconut tree?
Yep.
Right? Yep. It's going to change over time.
Yep.
And everything that he says, if it's not the same as what the Reconstructionists wrote in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, then it is a logical development out of that. And I'll give you a perfect example. So the way that Rush Dooney, the Christian Reconstructionists, talked about patriarchy was much softer than what people like Doug Wilson do. But it was never actually said out loud in my presence anyway. But there was this understanding of how family structures were the building block of society that lent itself to a hunch that maybe they certainly wouldn't have voted for the women's right to vote. Whether they wanted to undo it or not, not so clear. Nobody ever said it. And even when I was writing the book, there was the rise of something called the family integrated church movement. Scott Brown, these folks were connected to Doug Phillips. And I don't actually know what the status of that movement is now, but they were building a network of churches, some of which would be totally on board with everything that they said, but others were just enough on board that they put them in their network. So you could go to their website if you moved across the country and you wanted to find a family integrated church and you'd find these churches. But you know how things change over time. And they thought, oh, this is a way to bring people, to bring churches in to more of our way of thinking about things. And the family, and if you got down in the details of the family integrated church materials, you found that at least at church, in terms of ecclesiastical structures, in terms of church polity, the voting was done by men as representatives of their families. Now, they didn't necessarily slide on over to the suggestion that women shouldn't have the right to vote in civil society, although Doug Phillips kind of said stuff like that on occasion. Not broadly, very secretive about it. But now you hear all kinds of people saying that. People in Doug Wilson's circles.
Yeah, very clear.
Those people who have embraced the notion of Christian nationalism and taken it on as you know, they will out not say that now.
Yep.
And I think that's partly because it's really a logical conclusion of the teachings early on. It's also partly because of what I was talking about earlier, how what we really have is an amalgamation of groups that come together with different commitments and concerns. And the whole tech bro world is deeply misogynistic. And while they don't have this kind of commitment to biblical law and theonomy, when they do have a commitment to misogyny and patriarchy, so the ways that those things mesh together isn't necessarily theologically coherent, but in practice on the ground, they make happy bedfellows.
Yeah. So
it'll be interesting to see what happens if they do get into power, because I think they will, like, the I, I can't imagine them getting along for very long. It wasn't long ago that these, you know, like Gary North would have thought that like these folks were deeply anti-Catholic, deeper anti-Catholic. And now there's a version of Catholicism that has made common cause with this version of Protestantism, but they don't necessarily see the world in the same ways.
No.
There's some deep cleavages there. They just don't show right now because they're working toward a common goal.
There are those who want to institute these policies tomorrow and would if they could. But it'd be a mistake to assume they're pinning their hopes and dreams on a presidential candidate over the next few years. Remember, Reconstructionists expect to see the downfall of society, the deconstruction of the American political system. Why would they care about a president over the next 4 years? They're waiting until it's their turn to reconstruct society. They're thinking hundreds of years down the road, generations after generations from now. This is in large part why there are such proponents of the Quiverful movement, having as many children as possible for as long as possible. The main man we're focusing on, Doug Wilson, has drawn from the theological and political well of R.J. Rushdoony, among others. So I asked Julie to draw these parallels for us.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. And the first one is, I think, in fact, I've been doing talks on this point lately, because reporters will call me and they'll say, so is Mike Johnson a member of the NAR? Well, I think these are the wrong questions.
Yeah.
Because if you get drawn into a back and forth on whether or not you can apply the label, you're not focusing on the important stuff, which is what their strategies are, what the long-term goals are, and what their time horizon is. You're not talking about those things. You're back and forth on whether or not somebody can appropriately be labeled X, Y, or Z. And from what I've said already about how social movements work, I don't care if you can call them that. I'll call them that or I'll not call them that. And it makes no difference if you can affix that label to that person or if you cannot. What matters is that there is a long-term strategy to bring every aspect of American culture and then really the whole world under the lordship of Christ in this context called theonomy, with what's called the exercise of dominion and a specific articulation of what that means. So again, going back to the very beginnings of our conversation, if I just kind of walk down the street and talk to a neighbor and I tell them that somebody wants to have a biblical worldview, that sounds fine to most people, because most people think of the, you know, oh, okay, well, you know, Jesus loved the sinners and there's a Sermon on the Mount and there's, you know, there's good stuff in there, right? But it's the Bible is a, isn't a, first of all, it isn't all Bible, right? It's a collection of books for which we have actually no originals. Actually, we have fragments of the oldest parts that we have are fragments that aren't even originals, translated multiple times, chosen in a political process, right? The process of canonicity, like there were books that churches thought of as sacred texts that didn't make it into the canon. You know, there's a bunch of gospels out there that the church said, nah, not so much. And they did this based on their apostolic teaching authority. Okay. But that collection of fragments of texts has been read to mean all kinds of, you know, that the slave owners and the slaves in the U.S. South both worked their worldviews out of a biblical text, on that same text. So depending on which parts you're looking at, right? This is how you get you get different versions of what a biblical worldview is. But Doug Wilson's understanding of what the world would look like if you apply biblical law to every part of society, which he wants to do, his understanding of that is, it may be in some places a little divergent, but Christian Reconstructionists disagreed over things themselves.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
You know, Jim Jordan said all that stuff about the death penalty didn't mean that you should have the death penalty. It meant that was the most you could have. Okay. So there is, I don't see a qualitative difference here. And I'm not interested in whether or not I can put the label on him. I'm interested in whether or not he's embarked on a project that I think is detrimental to democracy and detrimental to the basic rights of a whole lot of us.
Doug would differ with Rushdoony about the deconstruction of American society and the reconstruction of an entirely new society. But he would agree with Rushdoony that our society should be largely, if not entirely, based upon biblical law. The continuum example I provided a little earlier in this episode helps understand this parallel. Doug would be somewhere in the middle between America was or is a Christian society, and we gotta go back to that, and America was never a Christian society and could never be. We gotta build that. It's much too simplistic to label him either or. Jerome Kapolsky talked about the differences between the restorationists and the reconstructionists.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one way of thinking about it is to think about groups that are restorationist, or they describe themselves as restorationist, or are, you know, trying to do something new, trying to have our new founding.
Yeah.
Now, even restorationists, often they're trying to restore an imagined past, right?
And, yeah. And so, yeah.
Right. They invent that imagined past, right? I'm sure you've come across some historic, right? Yeah. Right. David Barton, right? We'll just,
yep.
If we don't have the quote, we'll create the quote.
Yeah.
But the restorationist idea was like America was this providential project, that God was behind the American project. And it was really kind of, you know, with some bumps like the Civil War before, right?
Yeah.
It was right until the 1940s and 50s. And then the secularists come in and it's all a decline.
The post-war consensus.
Right. And you can pick up a track like Jerry Falwell's Listen America.
Yep. Yep.
Classic restorationist track.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there are those who are like, well, actually the founding was flawed. You know, maybe the founders didn't like make all the right decisions. Maybe this wasn't a providential founding. Maybe the Constitution isn't a sacred document. Maybe the Declaration of Independence is not biblical. Right? Maybe you need to go in a different direction. And I think if you look at sort of the Catholic post-liberals, that's certainly the position, right? You read Patrick Deneen. Patrick Deneen is very clear in why liberalism failed, that America is a liberal project all the way down. And there's nothing you don't want to restore the liberal project that has just brought us to where we are. So you need a new founding, a better founding, a more true founding. I think if you look at something like Yoram Hazony's book, mm-hmm. on conservatism, you see this kind of equivocation, right? Like on the one hand, yeah, Washington and Hamilton and John Jay, they were really men of the national conservative disposition, but they maybe didn't do a good enough job on this religion thing, right? So maybe we need to tweak it there. So a kind of this hybrid, like a red, and in a way, you know, you can, you know, I mentioned earlier the Christian Amendment movement in the 1870s, where you had this funny paradox of a group that is their vanguard, essentially saying the United States was never properly founded, that's bringing into this coalition other groups who are like, well, we need to shore up what we think was right. We need to tweak it a little bit in order to preserve what. So is it a restoration? Is it a refounding? We can have that conversation.
Again, to put simplistically, more majority folks are restorationists, and we need to rebuild a Christian society from the ground up are reconstructionists. They share a desire to see God's law, the judicial law of the Old Testament, become the law of the land, but how they see that coming to fruition differs widely. Underlying all of this, both disagreement and agreement between these two ends of the far-right Christian political continuum is a tendency towards reactionary engagement. I made this point at the beginning of episode 1. Doug Wilson is a reactionary theologian, cultural commentator, and political theorist. That comes from his Reconstructionist roots. Here is Michael McVicker on Rushdoony as a reactionary thinker.
Well, it's a hypothetical, right? So yep. I want to be really careful to answer a hypothetical like that. One of the things that marked Rushdoony was a kind of pugnacious contrarianism, right? It's something deeply embedded in his character. Now, I mean, how is there anything natural about that, right? Is there something genetic, or is there something, contextual? I don't know where that kind of attitude comes from. But it is really clear that by the time he is sort of a young adult, like late teenage, you know, young adult, coming of age in California, it is really crystal clear that a lot of his identity is by negation. That is, he is situating himself vis-a-vis larger institutions And he is sort of pushing back against those. You know, he was, by his own admission, as a younger man, he was progressive. So I'm talking about like adolescent through teenage years, maybe even into early college. And what's interesting about that is it follows a trajectory of a lot of conservatives in his own generation, right?
Yep.
He comes of age during the New Deal. He's progressive on labor issues. He's also progressive on free speech and personal liberty issues. He is, I've got a couple of points in like his correspondence in his diaries where he makes references to his connections with the ACLU during his like, you know, late high school, early college days. I don't know if he was ever a member of the organization. He might have been. Maybe I mentioned it in my book. I can't remember. Regardless, he's sympathetic to that more progressive sort of worldview. That may be because he was coming from a more conservative sort of Armenian community. And as he goes to college, he starts identifying more negatively against that, right? Mm-hmm. Pushing back against it. So that's kind of a word salad response to you. But what I do think is true in terms of the way that you framed the question is his identity is at least partially coming from a negation of what he sees as a kind of elite. Elite is probably the best way of putting it. The sort of elites and institutions. And he's saying, you know, I'm going to push back on those elites and I'm going to either encourage them to pump the brakes on their positions, or I'm going to say that they are simply wrong and I have a better solution to these kind of problems. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite likely had he had a slightly different upbringing, he would have been, you know, a pugnacious kind of liberal figure. Although I do think one thing that would be a consistent sort of through line is a kind of aggressive libertarianism, right? And that doesn't necessarily have to fall to the right or to the left. You can have a different view of like individual agency in both of these models that might have allowed him to be more progressive in his worldview. One other quick point. It is worth noting that as he is transitioning from being an undergraduate to a kind of like graduate student in his theological work at Pacific School of Religion, and then eventually working as a missionary in a mission in Nevada, he is trying to pursue an academic career, and that is systematically squelched by other academics. And I don't quite say it out loud in what I wrote about him, but it's pretty clear that led to a lot of resentment about academics and the way that they control access to things like publishing and resources in the academy. And I do think that is another aspect to it. Had he managed to become, you know, a kind of either somebody working in a seminary or in a small college somewhere, it might have fundamentally changed the trajectory he was on.
One of these reactions was towards the government schooling system, otherwise known as public schools. One of the dead giveaways that someone is building off of Rushdoony's thought, if they call public schools government schools. People don't join Reconstructionist online communities, forums, social media platforms, podcasts, conferences, or what have you, because of an initial theological agreement, although it does happen. It generally starts with schooling. They're convinced the radical, secular, woke, leftist, pro-LGBT, and all other qualifiers of the government schooling system is indoctrinating their kids to transition genders, dye their hair purple, and take on 157 new pronouns. You'll see young men join because they need something to belong to, and young families because they're scared for their kids. I asked Julie Ingersoll about the private schooling movement of the 50s and 60s, which then morphed into the homeschooling movement of the 80s and 90s, right around the time Doug Wilson rose to fame in the same circles. Who'd have thunk?
But I think what you put your finger on here probably is the most important question in this moment, because too many people think that if Donald Trump loses the election in November, that things will be fine, that all this stuff will go away. And the reason that it won't is because, unlike the left, if you want to call it that, but really, okay, so Nicole Wallace talks about the pro-democracy movement from which, you know, she worked for the Bush administration and for, you know, so she's a kind of disaffected Republican, but it isn't the left, like whatever that means, left. It's basically all of America from center right, left, right? Okay, but one of the problems that movement has in countering the dominionism of people like Rushdoony and Doug Wilson, is that that movement, our movement, the mainstream American movement, thinks in terms of an election cycle or a current crisis. Christian Reconstructionists think in terms of a millennium.
Yep. Yeah. That's, I was about
to say,
they're
millennial.
Yeah. They're very long-term thinkers. Yep.
Maybe more, but even on a small scale, people like Doug Phillips, who headed up one of the biggest homeschool movements that was completely rooted in Christian Reconstructionism. It exists no more because of a scandal.
Yeah. Vision Forum you're talking about.
Yes. Vision Forum sold a package of materials to homeschooling families.
Yep.
By which the family could build their own plan, a 200-year plan for a family dynasty.
Yep.
They sold this packet of materials. It comes in the mail. You sit down at the dining room table and you sit with your family and you plan out a 200-year strategy to have a family dynasty. And it's a Christian Reconstructionist family dynasty.
Yeah, they're so not thinking every four-year cycle.
Of the next 86 days or however many, or if we're going to think in terms of an election cycle, we're not going to be able to address the kinds of strategies that we're up against. And that's why education is underneath all of this. And it's why the changes to how people understand education that the Reconstructionists fought for all the way back in the 1960s. It's why that's, when I say that the reason their influence outstripped their numbers was because of the way that they built a Christian education system. That's why it matters. Right. That's why they're talking about it, because what? So 60 years on, we are seeing the implications of the transformation of public education that Rushton, you wrote about in The Messianic Character of American Education in like 1962. I might have the year wrong, but like early 1960s, Rushton, you wrote The Messianic Character of American Education, which was the fundamental critique of schooling. That gives us all of the stuff that's going on in Florida right now with education, higher education, elementary, you know, Moms for Liberty. We have an election here tomorrow. Moms for Liberty is on the ballot. The Moms for Some People's Liberty is on the ballot. And the way that those Moms for Liberty are understanding public education can be traced right back to the 1960s with Rushdoony. So Doug Wilson is a little late on the scene, to be honest. You know, so they started Christian schools all through the 70s and 80s. And that other Christian school that I wrote about that I mentioned, actually, they helped Christian schools start all across the country. And they had a particular model of what a Christian school would look like. And it this predated the thing that is now called classical Christian education. But I happened to check back on their website when I was working on the book. So this was probably maybe 2010, something like that. And that's what they were calling what they were doing at that Christian Reconstructionist school in Northern Virginia. The actual, the shift in language about what one might call a Christian school and this move to shape it in terms of what they're calling classical Christian education, that is not part of what I've worked on. And I don't know that I can tell you exactly when and how that happened. But I can tell you that what they're doing is not qualitatively different from what Rushdoony advocated in the early 60s.
This also played into Rushdoony's understanding of the family unit as the core of political society, which I'll get into with Michael McVicker. The family decides how to educate their children because they are responsible. The state has no right over the education of the kids. The more kids you have, and the longer you can homeschool them, the farther from government reach they are. Rushdoony's society revolved around the family unit and grew with the amount of children they produced. Quiverful and the homeschooling movements are the vehicles for the rise of Reconstructionism in Christian circles. If you can outpopulate the nation with its plummeting birth rate, you've got a shot. But remember, this is a movement that thinks in generations, not years. You won't stop them at the next presidential election. Where do women fit in this picture? Doug Wilson and Joel Webbin, his wannabe protege, make a big deal about this proposed and futuristic society being exclusively male-run. And yet, there's a massive movement of women joining in, whether willingly or unwillingly. And while not spawned by the movement or necessarily paralleling it, the popularity of the trad wife glorifies something similar. But in this society, women are given no right to vote, likely no job prospects, and no voice. How do they get in and join? Here's Julie Ingersoll, who married into one.
Well, I've been thinking about this question since you sent me questions in advance. And so I've been pondering this a little bit because as a trained religious studies scholar, we practice this thing called epoche, where we try to bracket our own stuff. And so I have, while this, you know, this information is in the preface to my book, I don't hide it necessarily, but I don't normally, like, that's not the place from which I speak. I speak from my place as a scholar of religion. So it took a little bit of thinking, a little bit about how I talk about this. And I think that one of the things that just jumped out at me and caught my attention is how really different this far right, reformed, Calvinist, dominionist kind of Christian world is now from then. Because I didn't go in and embrace a sort of Doug Wilson version of Christianity. Mm-hmm. It was the rough edges of it that he and people like him just throw out there now for everybody who says for all the world and God to see.
Yep.
Those weren't there. So, for example, when I got married, I kept my last name. I've always considered myself a feminist. And while that made for some awkward family moments, my in-laws didn't love it. You know, there was a battle over whether or not there'd be obey in the marriage vows. But those were things that they were counterbalanced by, for example, a sense that the notion of dominion was really about a calling to make a difference in the world and to do something important, and that it applied to both men and women. Although I saw that evolve over time to where it became much more. So let me be clear. It was always patriarchal. I'm explaining a little bit about how, you know, as a 20-year-old, I don't think I saw it clearly, right? But you say, well, how could somebody not see that? If you're looking at Doug Wilson right now, you would say, how could somebody not see that? But I'm suggesting that it wasn't as in your face then. So, for example, no one in my circles opposed contraceptives. You know, the Quiverful movement was just getting, these were seeds of what became the Quiverful movement, but the Quiverful movement didn't exist yet. Yeah, my in-laws had a lot of kids. And they very clearly thought that that was part of the exercise of dominion, was to transform society in part by outnumbering the non-Christians, by which they meant everybody that wasn't their kind of Christian. But it just wasn't as in your face. Like the kinds of things that J.D. Vance is saying, they clearly thought that a woman's primary calling was to get married and raise a family. No doubt about that. But they didn't say that that was the only valid thing that women could do. So it really had. So one of the things I'm interested in with how I trace social movements and change over time is how movements develop over time. And I'm persuaded that there's no clear line of demarcation between this thing that we call religion and other kinds of social movements. It's a social movement like any other one. And things can be religious or not religious, and they move between those categories depending on what somebody is trying to do. And it seems to me that what happened is that people with a patriarchal theology married up politically with people who had other reasons for supporting patriarchy. Some of them are quite secular in terms of how we use that language. And I'm thinking about people like Peter Thiel, right? So you've got this amalgam of dominionist Christians, charismatic Christians, right-wing Catholics, tech bros, white supremacists, neo-Nazis. Right. You've got an amalgamation of all of those groups. And what happened was that they took from each other the ideas and frameworks that were useful to them and adopted them. So the kind of the patriarchal stuff got much more extreme.
Christian Reconstructionism has changed over the last few decades after Rush Dooney. The modern Reconstructionists aren't building off of Rush Dooney. Ingersoll felt the calling for both men and women to take dominion over the world and make it a better place. You see, this movement has morphed. It's not the same that was envisioned back in the 60s through to the 80s. While women today might join through marriage or birth to a movement that valorizes power and authority, what they joined a few decades ago promoted something closer to a flourishing society and bettering of it. Roles, while strict, were less oppressive than they were purported to be in these same circles today. Now, I don't believe this was intentional, but it certainly was a reaction. The rise of women in the workforce, birth control, Title IX, and more modern Reconstructionists attempt to buck the tide by taking rights away from women that they perceived are given them in society. Now back to McVicar, as he attempts to separate Rushdoony's thought from anything that looks like Christian nationalism today. If you thought Rushdoony was reconstructing a Christian nation, you might want to listen. What was his political project?
Well, that is incredibly complex. One of the things is, so Rushdoony wrote two really fascinating books, and they really are interesting. The Nature of the American System and This Independent Republic. These were two books that he wrote. They're relatively slim volumes, and he wrote them while he was on staff at the Volcker Fund. So they were part of his attempt to sort of fit himself into the sort of growing American conservative movement from that time. And Rushdoony took a view that the United States government, Rushdoony had a generally critical view of the founding and the implications of it. He viewed the Constitution as having Christian elements, but he also understood that the Constitution was a work that was cobbled together by humans. And so as a consequence of that, it was a flawed document. And in it was not, you know, a specific commitment to like Christian values. For him, the only true governing sort of law would have been biblical law. And that is not a component of the Constitution. So what Rushdoony actually saw the Constitution doing, though, was creating a kind of feudalistic, Calvinistic order. And that can be mind-bending for folks, but Rushdoony understood the early pre-Republican system in what would eventually be the United States, particularly in like the Massachusetts Bay Area, where Calvinism was the sort of dominant social and religious worldview. He understood that as an attempt to build a kind of feudal Protestant order. So not a Catholic feudal order, not a secular feudal order, but something that was uniquely decentralized and run according to Calvinistic principles or Presbyterian principles. And he saw the Constitution as opening up a kind of space for that. So when you read those early volumes, what you actually see Rushdoony talking about is most power should ultimately resolve to the county level under the sheriff, right? And so Rushdoony is not easy to pin down as what we might use today as a like Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
Rushdoony has no particular loyalty to the United States as a national entity or as a nation state. For him, the nation state is a pernicious, dangerous sort of conglomeration of power. The very idea that you would have a state that would sort of rule, govern a totality or a kind of geographic area is dangerous. What you want to do is you want to devolve power as locally as possible and get it as close to, for him, the primary governing unit, which is not the state, it's the family. So when you're talking about Rushdoony, you are not talking about somebody who is easily labeled a Christian nationalist in the contemporary terms. Gary North sort of took a similar view, but for him, the family was not the proximate governing unit. He was skeptical of Rushdoony's version of the family and was more willing to devolve power instead to the church, where the church would be the local governing unit. But the point of this is with both of these men who are sort of the founders of whatever this movement is, neither of them are easily labeled under a rubric of Christian nationalism. Christian, yes. Nationalists, maybe implicitly, and that they would view something like the United States as maybe superior to, I don't know, the Soviet Union in their contemporary sense. But they would have viewed both of those things as entities that were dangerous and problematic. So yoking that later, say through the 80s, with a worldview of, say, like a James Dobson or a Jerry Falwell or a Pat Robertson, right? Men who all, to a different degree, picked up Reconstructionist elements and sort of assimilated it into their worldviews. Those guys would have all been more nationalists and Christian nationalists in the sense that we might generically use that phrase today than Rushdoony or Gary North ever were.
Did you catch that? Rushdoony was skeptical of the nation state. He was skeptical, even fearful, of a powerful government imposing on its people. Do you remember what was at the center of Rushdoony's society? It was the family unit, not the government. The family decides what's best, the government does not. The government defers, it doesn't demand. This is entirely different from that which is propounded by Christian nationalists today, those who likely think they're building off of their Reconstructionist fathers in the faith. So the question must be asked, and I asked it to Dr. McVicker, would Rushdoony be considered a Christian nationalist? Is Christian Reconstructionism similar in any way to Christian nationalism?
Well, I mean, that's so interesting. I mean, one of the things with Rushdoony, I don't know if you're going to get into this. This may be the weeds, but, you know, Rushdoony has been adopted by a bunch of far-right groups. Like, at one point, they went by, and this would have been in, like, the middle part of the 2010s, late aughts, people were identifying as Kinist, K-I-N-I. Yep. Okay, so yep. You're yep. familiar with the term.
Yep. We talked about it. Yep.
Yeah, these are folks thinking that they're kind of these ethno identities, right? And they thought of Rushdoony as kind of falling into that. And
yep, very much so.
Yeah, on one level, Rushdoony was a racist. We've already talked about that, right?
Yep.
But I do think that when his son pushes back against that and says, no, Rushdoony would not have been a Kinist, I think he's right. I think Rushdoony would have been somebody who would have understood people as being Christian first, and that Christian status, really? Conversion status, would have trumped any kind of, I don't know, biological, ethno, whatever kind of identity. Now, that's not to say that, as I said, Rushdoony wasn't racist.
Of course, yeah.
That he wasn't a kind of, I don't want to call him a white supremacist. If you want to ask an interesting question about Rushdoony, ask whether he was white, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
These are me, yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
He is white, maybe by the racial standards of the United States, right? But
yeah, like lighter colored instead of being Caucasian.
Right, right. And, you know, what exactly is that ethnic status, right? And so Rushdoony was actually acutely aware of that. He knew he was Armenian. He knew that he was ethnically set apart and different than a lot of his peers. He was not Gary North, right? Gary North, who is WASPy and, you know, white bread Protestant all the way down. I mean, his dad was an FBI agent, for God's sakes, right? And you weren't an FBI agent circa 1968 when his father was investigating the MLK assassination. You were not an FBI agent if you were not white, right?
Really white, yeah.
Totally. You know, so there is a way that Rushdoony was attuned to the complexity of like ethnic and racial identity in a way that's not always obvious from his writings, but is clear when you're sort of attuned to it and you start looking for it, right?
Maybe this surprises you and maybe it doesn't. Maybe you fancy yourself a Christian nationalist and you hate listening to Sons of Patriarchy. Maybe you're a curious Christian trying to understand Christian nationalism, or you're a non-Christian who thinks all Christians are Christian nationalists. But modern Christian nationalism bears no resemblance to the political projects of old. This is why we're looking at the movement in Moscow, where it's come from historically, what it's built off of, where it's separated, and where it's going. I pressed Dr. McVicker further. How might Rushdoony have understood the modern movement of Christian nationalism? Is it anything he might sign on to and agree that it builds off his thought?
Boy, this is a hard question. You know, I try to keep up a little bit with like the publications of Chalcedon, you know, the foundation that he started and the work of his son. And occasionally we'll like dive into the podcasts and stuff that they produce. You know, I'm not sure what Rushdoony would make of the current movement. He was always hostile to elements of the Christian right. That is, the movement sort of coalesces around Reagan during the 80s and into the 90s. He always thought that that was a kind of co-option of his worldview and also a kind of corruption of it. Anybody who was looking for solutions at the national sort of government level was doing it wrong as far as Rushdoony was concerned, okay? So if your solution to contemporary problems is the federal government as it currently is, Rushdoony would look at folks and be pretty skeptical of that kind of claim, right? Now, I think where Rushdoony might find elements of alignment in the sort of contemporary right is a lot of the hostility to what people call the administrative state today, right? This idea of trying to prise apart the state, right, and devolve powers either to states or to local, you know, governance, or just generally to sort of undo the federal government as it is. I think Rush Dooney would have seen that. And I know Gary North saw that as positive, right? Hmm. Those things were good. Now, that is, I want to be careful here and not say that does not make these folks somehow where they would align with like the contemporary sort of MAGA movement or something.
Yep.
I think they would be deeply skeptical of a lot of that stuff. And it's not necessarily that they would be, they would certainly be skeptical of the rhetoric around Trump of I alone can fix it. That's almost messianic. I know that they would view that with deep skepticism, right? However, I do believe that they would look at an attempt to undo the federal government and see that as a positive thing. So there's a kind of dual track aspect here. And, you know, I have to be careful. I haven't sat down and tried to see where all of the movement is today on this. I'm only speaking from where Rush Dooney would be on this, having spent a lot of time with him and understanding that for him, the coalescing power in sort of large governmental centralized entities would have been something that he would have been not just skeptical of, he would have been hostile to. Hmm. Right. So that is not something that Rush Dooney would have wanted.
Rush Dooney wasn't a kinist, preferential to his own people group beyond any other. He was a racist and rather vile one at that. He didn't necessarily have a problem with slavery as an institution and was more in favor of Southern slavery than not. But that didn't mean he preferred his ethnicity over another, something you will find in modern Christian nationalist circles, most explicitly by people like Stephen Wolfe, Eric Kahn, William Wolfe, and Joel Webbin. They aren't building off the Reconstructionist fathers, they're making up something new. Rush Dooney held a deep distrust of the government, so much so he didn't want them, in any way, part of educating the offspring of his followers. Why, pray tell, would he want them governing and imposing legislation upon you? Rush Dooney was a libertarian, not an authoritarian. His theocracy was not a state-imposed legislation morality, but the different spheres of society operating under God's law. I'm not endorsing him, but it's nothing near what Christian nationalists assume it is. So, who are Christian nationalists building off of? It certainly isn't Christian Reconstructionists. It's their will to power and form of people like themselves. Before we conclude, I asked Dr. McVicker how Christian nationalists might be misunderstanding Rush Dooney and the Christian Reconstructionists of a few decades back. Here's his answer.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that, and I also have to admit this fully. I don't use social media. I'm not on it. You're not gonna find me there. And I know there's a lot of discussions happening about these kind of movements, whether it's Reconstruction or Reconstruction adjacent movements.
Yeah.
And so I have to plead a kind of ignorance here, but I can tell you, if people are trying to co-opt Rush Dooney into the sort of contemporary, whatever we would call conservatism today, if it is a conservatism that is focused on centralizing power in governmental institutions, Rush Dooney would be hostile to it. It's that simple. There is no true reading of Rush Dooney that allows you to say, oh, he would favor a large centralized governmental authority. He mm-hmm. does not do that. The way that he understands power is he primarily talks about three spheres of power, the church, the family, and the state. Okay. Those should be essentially at war with one another to make sure that none transcends the other in terms of power over human institutions. Now, he did put his sort of thumb on the scale and say that the family is ultimately the closest and most important governing institution, right? So this is his patriarchal, this is why he's influential and like Quiverful and stuff like that. But he did believe that they should all three essentially be competing for power in order that none of them could become quasi-godlike. He sees the state in the basically in the 1950s as rising to this kind of like messianic authority, right? And that is something that is for him fallen, corrupt, dangerous, ultimately satanic. And so you need to have those three elements or three spheres of power constantly sort of butting heads with one another to make sure that none of them becomes transcendent in human relationships. And that is not easily. That is not easily like liberal or conservative or progressive or authoritarian. It's none of those things. I mean, he's idiosyncratic. You cannot easily pin him down to the politics of a given moment. is part of what's appealing about him. If you spend some time with him, like real time with him, he is, in his own way, he is a deep thinker, even if some of what he comes up with is pretty shallow, right? In terms of things like, oh, let's just, you know, if we had the death penalty, maybe we could fix some of these problems, right? That's some of his shallowest thinking. But if you really read like this Independent Republic and the nature of the American system and his stuff on the messianic nature of American education, there's a lot going on in there that upends an easy co-option of Rushduni into some, you know, narrow political project. He doesn't easily fit into these contemporary discourses.
So we'll end with final thoughts from both Michael McVicker and Jerome Kapolsky. Here's McVicker first.
Knowing more about where the afterlives of this stuff on in social media and in more decentralized systems of knowledge production, right? It is where you asked the question early on about like, where does this come from? How does this come into being? You know, and I went into this thing about how Rushduni's lecturing everywhere. One of the things that I can't shake is that part of the reason why this movement grows is because of the decentralization of American Protestantism, right? As seminaries and their authority collapse, as denominational power collapses, right, in the main line, and then as fundamentalist and conservative groups fracture, right? I mean, how many different forms of Presbyterianism is there, right? Just pay attention to what's going on in the Methodist Church right now, right? All this authority is just being distributed out everywhere, right? And social media and the internet has only exacerbated this. You know, Rushduni's ministry grew through cassette tapes, through little lectures, through VCR tapes, right? That was the cutting edge of your ability to distribute ideas to anybody, right? Pamphlets, that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, what is it now? I mean, it's message boards were the cutting edge of the 90s, right? Now it's all this other, these social media channels. I can't even imagine how this stuff is mutating and metastasizing.
Rushduni can be co-opted because Rushduni isn't understood. Christian Reconstructionism is a victim of the decentralization of Christian authority, Christian denominations, and political thought. He's not used, he's misused. There's all sorts of problems with Rushduni, but as we tried showing throughout this episode, the reconstruction of nationalism is a fool's project, though it's what they're trying to do improve. And lastly, Jerome Kapolsky.
I think we should go back to where we started, which is the wisdom of the constitutional settlement. And the wisdom of having a state that doesn't have jurisdiction over matters pertaining to religion. And that the success of that settlement in allowing people of very different beliefs and practices to live more or less in harmony with one another. I think that is an important moral project that should be commended.
I love where Dr. Kapolsky ends, the wisdom of the constitutional settlement. We don't need to reconstruct what we don't need to deconstruct. The founders, though flawed, were right in the construction of a constitutional republic, that which gave broad rights to all religious groups and traditions, limited the government's control, but also provided the building blocks to the kind of society we have today. The modern Christian nationalist goal is to build a nation with the kind of people they want, exclude the people they don't, traditions they enjoy and not the traditions they don't, and isolate themselves from any intrusion of foreign thoughts or ideals. And maybe that sounds appealing to you. I don't know. Maybe those are based, the kind of place you'd like to live in. But I must admit, it sounds boring. A suburbia where all the homes look the same, everyone's wearing the same clothes, the music never changes, and the cuisine is bland. While sameness amidst cultural change sounds appealing, give it some time and you'll start wondering if you walked on the set of The Stepford Wives. More than that, it's not what society has ever looked like, nor will look like. There is richness to diversity, not just among people groups, but among tradition, which comes with and from those varying people groups. When you go house to house, neighborhood to neighborhood, and you notice smells changing, music changing, and the vibe is different. Sure, that could be scary because you are confronted with what you're not familiar with. And when you lose familiarity, discomfort sets in, which is never fun. But give it some time. walk around, get to know people of other faiths, of other backgrounds, those entirely dissimilar to yours. It can be difficult because you might think you share nothing in common with them. They might dress different from you, they might speak different from you, but that does something for and to you, beyond meeting another image bearer of God. It gives you appreciation for how you grew up, but also points out blind spots in the same, which can be scary. Knowing how you grew up, the town you grew up in, and the traditions you grew up with might have some unhealthy aspects of them, but wouldn't you rather know that than live in ignorance of it? It's also a preview of the heavenly realities, when God's law will dominate. Not because the government mandates it, but because it springs out of your heart and soul. When society isn't destroyed to be raised up, but is renewed because Christ has been raised up. When we're not waiting for the denigration of all we hold dear, but the eternity of eternities that give us the time to worship with those we've never met, from ages we've never inhabited, and traditions we never enjoyed. We look not for the day of reconstruction, but the day of resurrection. We don't build that hope now. We see peaks of it from what God is building in Christ now. We're not hoping for a new nationalism, but a new creation. We look not for the reconstruction of nationalism, a fool's errand, but the resurrection to new life, Christ's errand. I want to give my thanks to Michael McVicker, Julie Ingersoll, Jerome Kopolsky, and Catherine Stewart for their time and expertise. I learned a lot, and I hope you have as well. In our next episode, we'll move from what Christian nationalism is to what Christian nationalism does. That's episode 6, The Fruits of Nationalism. See you then. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.